English Listening Comprehension Test, C1 Level, Valencian Community, 2020. Now you will hear the instructions for the listening test. You will have time to read all the questions for all the tasks in the exam. At the beginning of each listening, you will hear this sound. You can make notes or write your answers while you're listening, but remember that you will also have time to write your answers at the end of each exercise. Please, read the instructions for each exercise carefully. If you have any questions, ask them now, as you will not be able to talk during the listening test. Please, look at task 1. You will hear a program called Millennial Mythbusting. For questions 1 to 7, choose the correct answer A, B or C. Question 0 is an example. Write your answers in the boxes provided on the answer sheet. You will hear the recording twice. Now, you have 1.5 minutes to read the questions.
When the Great Recession ended in 2009, Jess was 23 years old. She was working lots of odd jobs and was getting paid close to the minimum wage.
Yeah, and throughout a lot of her 20s, like a lot of us, Jess would end up working her way into better jobs. But for a while, she stayed living at home with her parents and tried to save money because she was stressed about the nearly $50,000 in student debt that she needed to pay down. Jess is not alone. Compared to earlier generations, young adults now... And yes, fine, I hate the word, but we'll call them millennials. Millennials are living at home longer, they're getting married later, they're having children later, and they're putting off buying houses. And this has led some people from earlier generations to label millennials as lazy or coddled or afraid of becoming adults to make commitments and put down roots. But that is a bum rap. I'm Cardiff Garcia.
And I'm Sally Herships. Today, we go millennial myth-busting.
To understand the economic experiences of young adults, especially after the Great Recession 10 years ago, there was one economist I knew we had to call.
I'm Gray Kimbrough, and I'm an economist at American University.
Gray has been referred to by the Washington Post as a serial millennial myth debunker. He says that the reputation millennials have gotten as lazy is nonsense, and there is data to back it up.
By the way, millennials are young adults who are now between the ages of roughly 22 to 38. And the place we're going to start, the place we have to start, is with the economy.
Gray looked at the average amount that the U.S. economy has grown in the 10 years after each member of a generation reached the age of 18. He did this analysis for the millennial generation, Gen X, that's me and Cardiff, and the baby boomers, like our parents. One trend, for example, is that millennials do live at home for longer than earlier generations did. Young adults, in general, had steadily been moving out of their parents' houses at later and later ages, starting in the 60s and 70s. But that delay started increasing by a lot around the year 2000, when the first millennials were around 18 or 19 years old. And Gray says that trend has continued.
Young women and men in their 20s are more likely to live with their parents now than any time since World War II.
Gray says, actually, the most likely reason that young adults have been living at home longer and putting off buying houses is the economy, not because they're irresponsible or afraid of entering adulthood. The age when young adults get married is getting higher, but that has been a steady trend since the 1960s. It has not accelerated. It's not some new thing that started with millennials.
And that's why, Gray says, it's reasonable to think that the tough economy, the tough labor market for millennials, has played a role.
Plus, a much higher share of millennials go to college and graduate than people from earlier generations. And so the amount of college debt has climbed a lot since the middle of the last decade, which also makes it harder for young adults to afford houses.
So take all these things in combination, and you can see that the reason young adults have put off these milestones like buying houses and having kids does not match the stereotype of the lazy and self-absorbed millennial.
And if you want more proof Gray is not finished busting millennial myths, there's one that really annoys him. It's the myth that says millennials are disloyal to their employers, hopping from job to job, unable to stay put in one place. Gray says young adults now switch jobs at much lower rates than Gen Xers and baby boomers did when they were young.
Job switching drops quite a bit around 2000, 2001. Stays kind of at that level for a while, and then they were hit again by the Great Recession. And they've been kind of steadily climbing back, but not to the levels that they were before 2000.
So yeah, a lot of these trends are due to the economy. But we should note, there is an optimistic spin that you can put on the economic experiences of millennials. Remember Jess Dupree, the millennial who spent her 20s paying off her debt? Her story has a happy ending. She just got a new job in Houston, Texas, working for Peroni, the beer company, that pays a lot more than her last job. But she says that her struggles to get there ended up making her more cautious and responsible in her approach to making big-ticket purchases, like a house. So think about it all this way. This is purely speculative, but with more college degrees than prior generations, young adults now have set themselves up to be more productive in the economy for the long term. And they also could be less likely to inflate a huge housing market bubble or other bubble from buying things that they couldn't really afford. That also might end up being good for the economy in the long run because it makes financial crises less likely and it makes economic growth more sustainable.
Now listen again.
When the Great Recession ended in 2009, Jess was 23 years old. She was working lots of odd jobs and was getting paid close to the minimum wage.
Yeah, and throughout a lot of her 20s, like a lot of us, Jess would end up working her way into better jobs. But for a while, she stayed living at home with her parents and tried to save money because she was stressed about the nearly $50,000 in student debt that she needed to pay down. Jess is not alone. Compared to earlier generations, young adults now, and yes, fine, I hate the word, but we'll call them millennials, Millennials are living at home longer, they're getting married later, they're having children later, and they're putting off buying houses. And this has led some people from earlier generations to label millennials as lazy or coddled or afraid of becoming adults to make commitments and put down roots. But that is a bum rap. I'm Cardiff Garcia.
And I'm Sally Herships. Today, we go millennial myth-busting.
To understand the economic experiences of young adults, especially after the Great Recession 10 years ago, there was one economist I knew we had to call.
I'm Gray Kimbrough, and I'm an economist at American University.
Gray has been referred to by the Washington Post as a serial millennial myth debunker. He says that the reputation millennials have gotten as lazy is nonsense, and there is data to back it up.
By the way, millennials are young adults who are now between the ages of roughly 22 to 38. And the place we're going to start, the place we have to start, is with the economy.
Gray looked at the average amount that the U.S. economy has grown in the 10 years after each member of a generation reached the age of 18. He did this analysis for the millennial generation, Gen X, that's me and Cardiff, and the baby boomers, like our parents. One trend, for example, is that millennials do live at home for longer than earlier generations did. Young adults, in general, had steadily been moving out of their parents' houses at later and later ages, starting in the 60s and 70s. But that delay started increasing by a lot around the year 2000, when the first millennials were around 18 or 19 years old. And Gray says that trend has continued.
Young women and men in their 20s are more likely to live with their parents now than any time since World War II.
Gray says actually the most likely reason that young adults have been living at home longer and putting off buying houses is the economy, not because they're irresponsible or afraid of entering adulthood. The age when young adults get married is getting higher, but that has been a steady trend since the 1960s. It has not accelerated. It's not some new thing that started with millennials.
And that's why, Gray says, it's reasonable to think that the tough economy, the tough labor market for millennials, has played a role.
Plus, a much higher share of millennials go to college and graduate than people from earlier generations. And so the amount of college debt has climbed a lot since the middle of the last decade, which also makes it harder for young adults to afford houses.
So take all these things in combination, and you can see that the reason young adults have put off these milestones like buying houses and having kids does not match the stereotype of the lazy and self-absorbed millennial.
And if you want more proof, Gray is not finished busting millennial myths. There's one that really annoys him. It's the myth that says millennials are disloyal to their employers, hopping from job to job, unable to stay put in one place. Gray says young adults now switch jobs at much lower rates than Gen Xers and baby boomers did when they were young.
Job switching drops quite a bit around 2000, 2001. Stays kind of at that level for a while, and then they were hit again by the Great Recession. And they've been kind of steadily climbing back, but not to the levels that they were before 2000.
So yeah, a lot of these trends are due to the economy, but we should note there is an optimistic spin that you can put on the economic experiences of millennials. Remember Jess Dupree, the millennial who spent her 20s paying off her debt? Her story has a happy ending. She just got a new job in Houston, Texas, working for Peroni, the beer company, that pays a lot more than her last job. But she says that her struggles to get there ended up making her more cautious and responsible in her approach to making big-ticket purchases, like a house. So think about it all this way. This is purely speculative, but with more college degrees than prior generations, young adults now have set themselves up to be more productive in the economy for the long term. And they also could be less likely to inflate a huge housing market bubble or other bubble from buying things that they couldn't really afford. That also might end up being good for the economy in the long run because it makes financial crises less likely and it makes economic growth more sustainable.
Now you have 1 minute to check your answers. Please, look at the second exercise. Listen to some extracts in which seven people talk about depression and overcoming it. Match extracts 1 to 7 to what they say. Extract 0 is an example. There are two statements that do not correspond to any extracts. Write your answers in the boxes provided on the answer sheet. You will hear the recording twice. You now have 1 minute to read the statements. Example.
I was sitting at a coffee shop with my friend, and she kind of asked me something like, what do you think of God? And, you know, I think he's somebody who really loves me. And I kind of, I don't know if that's the exact words I said, but something along those lines. And as soon as I said it, I just remember God speaking into my heart. He said so clearly, Jessica, I love you. Come to me. Ever since then, I've followed that light, and my depression has completely gone away. I've discovered that all my happiness lies in Jesus alone, and so that's why my depression is gone.
Speaker 1.
I had a lot of people around me who were just after what I gave them. So it's about finding people who care about you and support. And again, I've now become a support for other people as well, so in turn that kind of goes around. When I was a kid, I always wanted to change the world because all kids think they're going to be superheroes. But I have so many messages in terms of just young girls and how the mental illness and depression is not something to be ashamed of. And I wish at that time I had realized that other people go through it, that I can talk to other people, that you're not alone, you're not an alien. And, you know, my message has always been to accept yourself no matter what, to love yourself, to embrace your flaws. I think flaws are the things that make us special. The cracks within us are the beautiful parts that need to have light shed on them, otherwise they're just left.
Speaker 2.
I did have a hard time having relationships. I withdrew from everybody. I chose not to talk. I would get off the phone quickly or not even take calls. I wouldn't return emails, and after a while people stopped calling and stopped emailing. They thought I neglected our friendship, and in reality, I didn't know how to deal with being a friend or being supportive at all. I just couldn't get out of my own way. I couldn't see a future. I couldn't plan the next week, let alone the next month. I really did never see myself getting out of that hole. I didn't see anything. And I'm hard-pressed to remember exactly what it was. It may have been the birth of my nephew, and I just decided that I wanted to be around for him, and that just sort of prompted me that I needed to stop pushing away and then go find the help that I needed, even if it wasn't through family and friends. And so I turned to the VA counseling system.
Speaker 3.
The next thing I want to share is gratitude journaling. Again, you hear a lot about gratitude journaling, but do people actually do it? Do you actually do it? I have had probably 50 guests on my podcast talk about the benefits of gratitude journaling, and it wasn't until Benjamin Hardy, in a willpower challenge in our private membership group, our mastermind, talked about the benefits of journaling that I actually took it seriously, because he talked about it for the benefits of success and goal setting and things that spoke to me. But I have to say that the gratitude journaling has really turned on my reticular activator, and I'm constantly looking for things to be thankful and grateful and happy for, which totally helps me stave off the blues. So every single morning, I just write out a paragraph of all the things that I'm happy for.
Speaker 4.
I tried to get answers from doctors. I was desperate for help. So in a last-ditch attempt to get better, I set out on one of the hardest journeys of my life, a 90-day mission to biohack my mind and body back to health. With a little energy that I did have, I traveled the world to interview the top neuroscientists, doctors, and biohackers, and I underwent lab tests, tested smart drugs, and tried wearable devices designed to reduce stress and reprogram my mind based on the latest research into neuroscience and biohacking. And the truth is, we can't become peak performers until we apply psychology and biochemistry in tandem. The two are interlinked, they can't be separated. One fuels the other, and the other depletes the first.
Speaker 5.
Here I was, completely broken. I could barely see the point in staying alive. I felt so ashamed of myself. And these people, they just treated me like a person. I felt validated and I had some hope. And like, you know, I knew that like, okay, when I ask for help, help is given and it works. And I knew that this break I was looking for could be found in a hospital room. Today, I am in remission from my depression for the first time in who knows how long. I'm getting to know parts of me that aren't just anxious. I'm majoring in social work, and I really want to work in behavioral health with children, specifically in a crisis or inpatient setting. I've started to become really passionate about advocating once I made it to the other side, because I almost didn't make it.
Speaker 6.
On my journey to wellness, when I really started to put time into myself, I started to eat better, I started to exercise, but really importantly, I started to value myself. I remember sitting on the side of my bed one day, living in my mom's house, and I took a big deep breath. I remember as I let out my breath, I went, wow, I feel really content, probably for the first time ever. And the really big learning in this for me was that I didn't have anything. And now when I mean I didn't have anything, I mean nothing in material. So I didn't have my own home, my own car. And at the time, I was struggling to make a living, living on welfare and the bits and pieces of work that came in. I realized in that moment that before this, I'd been looking for happiness in external things outside of myself, but really we have everything that we need inside.
Speaker 7.
Your mind is so powerful. Your mind is like the most powerful thing that exists, and it can either be your best friend or your worst enemy. So pay attention to the thoughts that you're thinking and the words that you're saying. Watch your thoughts because they become words, and watch your words because they become actions, and watch your actions because that determines your destiny. But we want to place responsibility outside of ourselves. We want to say, this person did this to me, and this person did that, and that, and that, and that, and that. But it's like, no. Doesn't matter what happens to you, it just matters how you deal with what happens to you, because you're the one who has to take responsibility for that. And the mind is so powerful, and this links back to meditation. The mind.
Now listen again. Speaker 1.
I had a lot of people around me who were just after what I gave them. So it's about finding people who care about you and support. And again, I've now become a support for other people as well. So in turn, that kind of goes around. When I was a kid, I always wanted to change the world because all kids think they're going to be superheroes. But I have so many messages in terms of just young girls and how the mental illness and depression is not something to be ashamed of. And I wish at that time I had realized that other people go through it, that I can talk to other people, that you're not alone, you're not an alien. And, you know, my message has always been to accept yourself no matter what, to love yourself, to embrace your flaws. I think flaws are the things that make us special. The cracks within us are the beautiful parts that need to have light shed on them, otherwise they're just left.
Speaker 2.
I did have a hard time having relationships. I withdrew from everybody. I chose not to talk. I would get off the phone quickly or not even take calls. I wouldn't return emails, and after a while, people stopped calling and stopped emailing. They thought I neglected our friendship, and in reality, I didn't know how to deal with being a friend or being supportive at all. I just couldn't get out of my own way. I couldn't see a future. I couldn't plan the next week, let alone the next month. I really did never see myself getting out of that hole. I didn't see anything. And I'm hard-pressed to remember exactly what it was. It may have been the birth of my nephew, and I just decided that I wanted to be around for him, and that just sort of prompted me that I needed to stop pushing away and then go find the help that I needed, even if it wasn't through family and friends. And so I turned to the VA counseling system.
Speaker 3.
The next thing I want to share is gratitude journaling. Again, you hear a lot about gratitude journaling, but do people actually do it? Do you actually do it? I have had probably 50 guests on my podcast talk about the benefits of gratitude journaling, and it wasn't until Benjamin Hardy, in a willpower challenge in our private membership group, our mastermind, talked about the benefits of journaling that I actually took it seriously, because he talked about it for the benefits of success and goal setting and things that spoke to me. But I have to say that the gratitude journaling has really turned on my reticular activator, and I'm constantly looking for things to be thankful and grateful and happy for, which totally helps me stave off the blues. So every single morning, I just write out a paragraph of all the things that I'm happy for.
Speaker 4.
I tried to get answers from doctors. I was desperate for help. So in a last-ditch attempt to get better, I set out on one of the hardest journeys of my life, a 90-day mission to biohack my mind and body back to health. With a little energy that I did have, I traveled the world to interview the top neuroscientists, doctors, and biohackers, and I underwent lab tests, tested smart drugs, and tried wearable devices designed to reduce stress and reprogram my mind based on the latest research into neuroscience and biohacking. And the truth is, we can't become peak performers until we apply psychology and biochemistry in tandem. The two are interlinked, they can't be separated. One fuels the other, and the other depletes the first.
Speaker 5.
Here I was, completely broken. I could barely see the point in staying alive. I felt so ashamed of myself. And these people, they just treated me like a person. I felt validated, and I had some hope. And, like, you know, I knew that, like, okay, when I ask for help, help is given, and it works. And I knew that this break I was looking for could be found in a hospital room. Today, I am in remission from my depression for the first time in who knows how long. I'm getting to know parts of me that aren't just anxious. I'm majoring in social work, and I really want to work in behavioral health with children, specifically in a crisis or inpatient setting. I've started to become really passionate about advocating once I made it to the other side, because I almost didn't make it.
Speaker 6.
On my journey to wellness, when I really started to put time into myself, I started to eat better, I started to exercise. But really importantly, I started to value myself. I remember sitting on the side of my bed one day, living in my mom's house, and I took a big deep breath. And I remember as I let out my breath, I went, wow, I feel really content, probably for the first time ever. And the really big learning in this for me was that I didn't have anything. And now when I mean I didn't have anything, I mean nothing in material. So I didn't have my own home, my own car. And at the time, I was struggling to make a living, living on welfare and the bits and pieces of work that came in. I realized in that moment that before this, I'd been looking for happiness in external things outside of myself, but really we have everything that we need inside.
Speaker 7.
Your mind is so powerful. Your mind is like the most powerful thing that exists, and it can either be your best friend or your worst enemy. So pay attention to the thoughts that you're thinking and the words that you're saying. Watch your thoughts because they become words, and watch your words because they become actions, and watch your actions because that determines your destiny. But we want to place responsibility outside of ourselves. We want to say, this person did this to me, and this person did that, and that, and that, and that, and that. But it's like, no. It doesn't matter what happens to you. It just matters how you deal with what happens to you. Because you're the one who has to take responsibility for that. And the mind is so powerful. And this links back to meditation. The mind.
Now you have 1 minute to check your answers. Please, look at the third exercise. Listen to a radio program about recycling. Fill in the gaps 1 to 12 with the exact word or words you hear, a maximum of 3 words per gap. Write your answers in capital letters and do not forget to copy your answers on the answer sheet. 0 is an example. You will hear the recording twice. You now have 2 minutes to read the sentences.
Hello and welcome to Planet Money. I'm Sarah Gonzalez.
And I'm Kenny Malone. Today on the show, recycling is on life support. Cities might be picking up your recyclables, but there's a very good chance they are not being recycled.
And that might be a good thing if you really care about the planet. To understand what went wrong in the world of recycling, we called economist Bevan Ashenmiller at Occidental College. Okay, Bevan also knows a lot about the economics of recycling, and she says the first thing you need to know is that in economics, we have goods and we have bads.
A good is something that you pay money to get. That's why we call it a good. We're very simple people. and a bad is something that you pay money for somebody to take it away.
But back in the 1990s, a few things happened that made all of our bads really attractive to China. China was making all this stuff and shipping it to the U.S. in these huge cargo ships.
They were bringing a lot of tankers into the U.S. that were dropping off materials, and it doesn't make sense to bring a tanker back empty.
So some smart person was like, well, then why don't we just fill those cargo ships up with something useful then?
Like empty water bottles. China was like, we can turn those things into like polyester socks and sweaters, which are basically just woven out of really, really, really thin plastic bottles.
And thus a market for our bads was born. And eventually, about half of the entire world's junk plastic was being sent to China, much of that coming from the U.S. And when this was working, it is what we imagine recycling to be. My peanut butter jar turning into freaking socks. I mean, that is a modern miracle. But then, just last year, something changed dramatically.
China said, this isn't worth it for us anymore. Turning your peanut butter jar into socks is creating too much pollution. And frankly, it's just too much work for us now. Because you guys aren't as good at triple rinsing your plastic as you think you are. And you're not even sorting it properly. There are milk jugs in with the peanut butter jars, lids still on, peanut butter still in the jar.
A total mess. And it used to be worth it for China to just go ahead and clean this stuff up and sort it out on their end. Because, you know, labor was cheap. And so cleaning and then recycling our old plastic was cheaper than creating new plastic.
But then China's economy evolved. Labor got more expensive. And China said, we don't want to be the world's garbage dump. An actual quote.
And so China instituted a new plan called the National Sword, their name for it. And in this plan, China said, we're only going to take recyclables if they are absolutely spotless and perfectly separated. Plus, we are going to stop taking 24 different kinds of junk, including some kinds of plastics, mixed paper, and certain metals. So the U.S. is now looking for another country that maybe doesn't care as much if our stuff is dirty, you know, the way it used to be with China.
So you expect the baton to be passed, and it has been passed.
This is Thomas Kinnaman, an environmental economist at Bucknell University.
Indonesia, India, Malaysia, these countries will accept some of this stuff.
Thomas is kind of the economist when it comes to looking at all the financial and environmental costs and benefits of recycling. If you just landfill a peanut butter jar, obviously that has costs, and Thomas takes that into account. But he says there are also costs to recycling. Like, think about what it entails to recycle that peanut butter jar.
A giant truck has to come to your home to pick up your peanut butter jar and then drive it somewhere to get sorted and then drive it to a recycling center and then probably put it on a train, which takes it to a boat, which takes your jar halfway around the world.
And that's where you start wondering, okay, wait a minute.
Is recycling worth it? And when you crunch the numbers, Thomas says, more recycling isn't always better for the planet. Sometimes it is worse, including in ways that you may not have thought of.
Here's sort of the untold story, is that China's ban may actually reduce the amount of plastic that ends up in the oceans. China was not very careful about what got into their ocean for a long period of time. And if some of the plastic piles were just too corrupted, they could do whatever they wanted with
they
it.
They dumped them in the ocean?
Countries historically dumped waste out in the ocean.
Now listen again.
Hello and welcome to Planet Money. I'm Sarah Gonzalez.
And I'm Kenny Malone. Today on the show, recycling is on life support. Cities might be picking up your recyclables, but there's a very good chance they are not being recycled.
And that might be a good thing if you really care about the planet. To understand what went wrong in the world of recycling, we called economist Bevan Ashenmiller at Occidental College. Okay, Bevan also knows a lot about the economics of recycling, and she says the first thing you need to know is that in economics, we have goods and we have bads.
A good is something that you pay money to get. That's why we call it a good. We're very simple people. and a bad is something that you pay money for somebody to take it away.
But back in the 1990s, a few things happened that made all of our bads really attractive to China. China was making all this stuff and shipping it to the U.S. in these huge cargo ships.
They were bringing a lot of tankers into the U.S. that were dropping off materials, and it doesn't make sense to bring a tanker back empty.
So some smart person was like, well, then why don't we just fill those cargo ships up with something useful then?
Like empty water bottles. China was like, we can turn those things into like polyester socks and sweaters, which are basically just woven out of really, really, really thin plastic bottles.
And thus a market for our bads was born. And eventually, about half of the entire world's junk plastic was being sent to China, much of that coming from the U.S. And when this was working, it is what we imagine recycling to be. My peanut butter jar turning into freaking socks. I mean, that is a modern miracle. But then, just last year, something changed dramatically.
China said, this isn't worth it for us anymore. Turning your peanut butter jar into socks is creating too much pollution. And frankly, it's just too much work for us now. Because you guys aren't as good at triple rinsing your plastic as you think you are. And you're not even sorting it properly. There are milk jugs in with the peanut butter jars, lids still on, peanut butter still in the jar.
A total mess. And it used to be worth it for China to just go ahead and clean this stuff up and sort it out on their end. Because, you know, labor was cheap. And so cleaning and then recycling our old plastic was cheaper than creating new plastic.
But then China's economy evolved. Labor got more expensive. And China said, we don't want to be the world's garbage dump. An actual quote.
And so China instituted a new plan called the National Sword, their name for it. And in this plan, China said, we're only going to take recyclables if they are absolutely spotless and perfectly separated. Plus, we are going to stop taking 24 different kinds of junk, including some kinds of plastics, mixed paper, and certain metals. So the U.S. is now looking for another country that maybe doesn't care as much if our stuff is dirty, you know, the way it used to be with China.
So you expect the baton to be passed, and it has been passed.
This is Thomas Kinnaman, an environmental economist at Bucknell University.
Indonesia, India, Malaysia, these countries will accept some of this stuff.
Thomas is kind of the economist when it comes to looking at all the financial and environmental costs and benefits of recycling. If you just landfill a peanut butter jar, obviously that has costs, and Thomas takes that into account. But he says there are also costs to recycling. Like, think about what it entails to recycle that peanut butter jar.
A giant truck has to come to your home to pick up your peanut butter jar and then drive it somewhere to get sorted and then drive it to a recycling center and then probably put it on a train, which takes it to a boat, which takes your jar halfway around the world.
And that's where you start wondering, okay, wait a minute.
Is recycling worth it? And when you crunch the numbers, Thomas says, more recycling isn't always better for the planet. Sometimes it is worse, including in ways that you may not have thought of.
Here's sort of the untold story, is that China's ban may actually reduce the amount of plastic that ends up in the oceans. China was not very careful about what got into their ocean for a long period of time. And if some of the plastic piles were just too corrupted, they could do whatever they wanted with
it. They dumped them in the ocean?
Countries historically dumped waste out in the ocean.
Now you have 1 minute to check your answers. This is the end of the English Listening Comprehension Test C1 Level, Valencian Community 2020.